get back to you. I don't know where Gordon is at the moment, and don't worry, I know how it is when you can't wait to turn the next page. They always keep you guessing till the end, don't they? It must have been Zbigniew that did it. Have a good weekend. She hung up. Richard hung up too, and sat staring at the box advertisement lying open in front of him in the yellow pages. It said, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. We solve the whole crime. We find the whole person. Phone today for the whole solution to your problem. Missing cats and messy divorces a speciality. 33A Peckender Street, London, N1. 01-354-9112. Peckender Street was only a few minutes walk away. Richard scribbled down the address, pulled on his coat, and trotted downstairs, stopping to make another quick inspection of the sofa. There must, he thought, be something terribly obvious that he was overlooking. The sofa was jammed on a slight turn in the long, narrow stairway. At this point, the stairs were interrupted for a couple of yards of flat landing, which corresponded with the position of the flat directly beneath Richard's. However, his inspection produced no new insights, and he eventually clambered on over it and out of the front door. In Islington, you can hardly hurl a brick without hitting three antique shops, an estate agent, and a bookshop. Even if you didn't actually hit them, you would certainly set off their burglar alarms, which wouldn't be turned off again till after the weekend. A police car played its regular game of dodgems down Upper Street and squealed to a halt just past him. Richard crossed the road behind it. The day was cold and bright, which he liked. He walked across the top of Islington Green, where Winers got beaten up, past the site of the old Collins Music Hall, which had got burnt down, and through Camden Passage, where American tourists get ripped off. He browsed among the antiques for a while and looked at a pair of earrings which he thought Susan would like, but he wasn't sure. Then he wasn't sure that he liked them, got confused, and gave up. He looked in at a bookshop and, on an impulse, bought an anthology of Coleridge's poems, since it was just lying there. From here, he threaded his way through the winding back streets, over the canal, past the council estates that lined the canal, through a number of smaller and smaller squares, till finally he reached Peckender Street, which had turned out to be a good deal further than he thought. It was the sort of street where property developers in large Jaguars drive around at the weekend salivating. It was full of end-of-lease shops, Victorian industrial architecture, and a short decaying late Georgian terrace, all just itching to be pulled down so that sturdy young concrete boxes could sprout in their places. Estate agents roamed the area in hungry packs, eyeing each other warily, their clipboards on a hair trigger. Number 33, when he eventually found it, neatly sandwiched between 37 and 45, was in a poorish state of repair, but no worse than most of the rest. The ground floor was a dusty travel agent's, whose window was cracked and whose faded BOAC posters were probably now quite valuable. The doorway next to the shop had been painted bright red, not well, but at least recently. A push button next to the door said, in neatly penciled lettering, Dominique, French lessons, troisième floor. The most striking feature of the door, however, was the bold and shiny brass plaque fixed in the dead centre of it, on which was engraved the legend, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Nothing else. It looked brand new. Even the screws that held it in place were still shiny. The door opened to Richard's push, and he peered inside. He saw a short and musty hallway, which contained little but the stairway that led up from it. A door at the back of the hall showed little sign of having been opened in recent years, and had stacks of old metal shelving, a fish tank, and the carcass of a bike piled up against it. Everything else, the walls, the floor, the stairs themselves, and as much of the rear door as could be got at, had been painted grey in an attempt to smarten it up cheaply. But it was now all badly scuffed, and little cups of fungus were peeking from a damp stain near the ceiling. The sounds of angry voices reached him, and, as he started up the stairs, he was able to disentangle the noise of two entirely separate but heated arguments that were going on somewhere above him. One ended abruptly, or at least half of it did, as an angry, overweight man came clattering down the stairs, pulling his raincoat collar straight. The other half of the argument continued in a torrent of aggrieved French from high above them. The man pushed past Richard and said, "Save your money, mate, it's a complete washout," and disappeared out into the chilly morning. The other argument was more muffled. As Richard reached the first corridor, a door slammed somewhere and brought that too to an end. He looked into the nearest open doorway. It led into a small ante-office. The other inner door leading from it was firmly closed. A youngish, plump-faced girl in a cheap blue coat was pulling sticks of makeup and boxes of Kleenex out of her desk drawer and thrusting them into her bag. "Is this the detective agency?" Richard asked her tentatively. The girl nodded, biting her lip and keeping her head down. "And is Mr. Gently in?" "He may be," she said, throwing back her hair, which was too curly for throwing back properly. "And then again, he may not be. I am not in a position to tell. It is not my business to know of his whereabouts. His whereabouts are, as of now, entirely his own business." She retrieved her last pot of nail varnish and tried to slam the drawer shut. A fat book sitting upright in the drawer prevented it from closing. She tried to slam the door again without success. She picked up the book, ripped out a clump of pages, and replaced it. This time she was able to slam the drawer with ease. "Are you his secretary?" asked Richard. "I am his ex-secretary, and I intend to stay that way," she said, firmly snapping her bag shut. "If he intends to spend his money on stupid expensive brass plaques rather than on paying me, then let him. But I won't stay to stand for it, thank you very much. Good for business, my foot. Answering the phones properly is good for business, and I'd like to see his fancy brass plaque do that. If you'll excuse me, I'd like to storm out, please." Richard stood aside, and out she stormed. "And good riddance!" shouted a voice from the inner office. A phone rang and was picked up immediately. "Yes?" answered the voice from the inner office testily. The girl popped back for her scarf, but quietly so her ex-employer wouldn't hear. Then she was finally gone. "Yes, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. How can we be of help to you?" The torrent of French from upstairs had ceased. A kind of tense calm descended. Inside, the voice said, "That's right, Mrs. Sunderland. Messy divorces are our particular speciality." There was a pause. "Yes, thank you, Mrs. Sunderland. Not quite that messy." Down went the phone again, to be replaced instantly by the ringing of another one. Richard looked around the grim little office. There was very little in it. A battered chipboard veneer desk, an old grey filing cabinet, and a dark green tin waste paper bin. On the wall was a Duran Duran poster, on which someone had scrawled in fat red felt-tip, "Take this down, please." Beneath that, another hand had scrawled, "No." Beneath that again, the first hand had written, "I insist that you take it down." Beneath that, the second hand had written, "Won't." Beneath that, "You're fired." Beneath that, "Good." And there the matter appeared to have rested. He knocked on the inner door, but was not answered. Instead, the voice continued, "I'm very glad you asked me that, Mrs. Rawlinson. The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. I do not concern myself with such petty things as fingerprint powder, telltale pieces of pocket fluff, and inane footprints. I see the solution to each problem as being detectable in the pattern and web of the whole. The connections between causes and effects are often much more subtle and complex than we, with our rough and ready understanding of the physical world, might naturally suppose, Mrs. Rawlinson. Let me give you an example. If you go to an acupuncturist with toothache, he sticks a needle instead into your thigh. Do you know why he does that, Mrs. Rawlinson?" "No, neither do I, Mrs. Rawlinson, but we intend to find out. A pleasure talking to you, Mrs. Rawlinson. Goodbye." Another phone was ringing as he put this down. Richard eased the door open and looked in. It was the same Svlad, or Dirk, Celi. Looking a little rounder about the middle, a little looser and redder about the eyes and the neck, but it was still essentially the same face that he remembered most vividly, smiling a grim smile as its owner climbed into the back of one of the Black Marias of the Cambridgeshire Constabulary 8 years previously. He wore a heavy old light brown suit, which looked as if it had been worn extensively for bramble-hacking expeditions in some distant and better past. A red checked shirt, which failed entirely to harmonise with the suit, and a green striped tie, which refused to speak to either of them. He also wore thick metal-rimmed spectacles, which probably counted at least in part for his dress sense. "Ah, Mrs. Bluthal, how thoroughly uplifting to hear from you," he was saying. "I was so distressed to hear that Miss Tiddles has passed over. This is desperate news indeed. And yet, should we allow black despair to hide from us the fairy light in which your blessed Moggy now forever dwells? I think not. Hark, I think I hear Miss Tiddles meowing e'en now. She calls to you, Mrs. Bluthal. She says she is content. She is at peace. She says she will be even more at peace when you've paid some bill or other. Does that ring a bell with you at all, Mrs. Bluthal? Come to think of it, I think I sent you one myself, not 3 months ago. I wonder if it can be that which is disturbing her eternal rest." Dirk beckoned Richard in with a brisk wave and then motioned him to pass the crumpled pack of French cigarettes that was sitting just out of his reach. "Sunday night, then, Mrs. Bluthal, Sunday night at 8:30. You know the address? Yes, I'm sure Miss Tiddles will appear, as I'm sure will your checkbook. Till then, Mrs. Bluthal, till then." Another phone was already ringing as he got rid of Mrs. Bluthal. He grabbed at it, lighting his crumpled cigarette at the same time. Ah, Mrs. Sorskind, he said in answer to the caller. My oldest and, may I say, most valued client. Good day to you, Mrs. Sorskind. Good day. Sadly, no sign as yet of young Roderick, I'm afraid, but the search is intensifying as it moves into what I am confident are its closing stages, and I'm sanguine that within mere days from today's date we will have the young rascal permanently restored to your arms and mewing prettily. Ah, yes, the bill, I was wondering if you had received it. Dirk's crumpled cigarette turned out to be too crumpled to smoke, so he hooked the phone onto his shoulder and poked around in the packet for another, but it was empty. He rummaged on his desk for a piece of paper and a stub of pencil, and wrote a note, which he passed to Richard. Yes, Mrs. Sorskind, he assured the telephone, I am listening with the utmost attention. The note said, Tell Secretary, get Siggs. Yes, continued Dirk into the phone, but as I have endeavoured to explain to you, Mrs. Sorskind, over the 7 years of our acquaintance, I incline to the quantum mechanical view in this matter. My theory is that your cat is not lost, but that his waveform has temporarily collapsed and must be restored, Schrödinger, Planck, and so on. Richard wrote on the note, You haven't got, Secretary, and pushed it back. Dirk considered this for a while, then wrote, Damn and blast on the paper, and pushed it to Richard again. I grant you, Mrs. Sorskind, continued Dirk blithely, that 19 years is, shall we say, a distinguished age for a cat to reach, yet can we allow ourselves to believe that a cat such as Roderick has not reached it? And should we now, in the autumn of his years, abandon him to his fate? This surely is the time that he most needs the support of our continuing investigations. This is the time that we should redouble our efforts, and with your permission, Mrs. Sorskind, that is what I intend to do. Imagine, Mrs. Sorskind, how you would face him if you had not done this simple thing for him. Richard fidgeted with the note, shrugged himself, and wrote, I'll get them, on it, and passed it back once more. Dirk shook his head in admonition, then wrote, I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind. As soon as Richard had read this, Dirk took the note back and added, Get money from secretary to it. Richard looked at the paper thoughtfully, took the pencil, and put a tick next to where he had previously written, You haven't got secretary. He pushed the paper back across the table to Dirk, who merely glanced at it and ticked, I couldn't possibly, that would be most kind. Well, perhaps, continued Dirk to Mrs. Sorskind, you could just run over any of the areas in the bill that cause you difficulty, just the broader areas. Richard let himself out. Running down the stairs, he passed a young hopeful in a denim jacket and close-cropped hair, peering anxiously up the stairwell. Hey, any good, mate? He said to Richard. Amazing, murmured Richard, just amazing. He found a nearby newsagent's and picked up a couple of packets of Dies Blur for Dirk and a copy of the new edition of Personal Computer World, which had a picture of Gordon Way on the front. Oh, pity about him, isn't it? Said the newsagent. What? Oh, yes, said Richard. He often thought the same himself, but was surprised to find his feelings so widely echoed. He picked up a Guardian as well, paid and left. Dirk was still on the phone, with his feet on the table, when Richard returned, and it was clear that he was relaxing into his negotiations. Yes, expenses were, well, expensive in the Bahamas, Mrs. Sorskind. It is in the nature of expenses to be so, hence the name. He took the proffered packets of cigarettes, seemed disappointed there were only two, but briefly raised his eyebrows to Richard in acknowledgement of the favour he had done him, then waved him to a chair. The sounds of an argument conducted partly in French drifted down from the floor above. Of course I will explain to you again why the trip to the Bahamas was so vitally necessary, said Dirk gently, soothingly. Nothing could give me greater pleasure. I believe, as you know, Mrs. Sorskind, in the fundamental interconnectedness of all things. Furthermore, I have plotted and triangulated the vectors of the interconnectedness of all things and traced them to a beach in the Bahamas, which it is therefore necessary for me to visit from time to time in the course of my investigations. I wish it were not the case, and sadly, I am allergic to both sun and rum punches, but then we all have our crosses to bear, do we not, Mrs. Sorskind? A babble seemed to break out from the phone. You sadden me, Mrs. Sorskind. I wish I could find it in my heart to tell you that I find your scepticism rewarding and invigorating, but with the best will in the world, I cannot. I am drained by it, Mrs. Sorskind, drained. I think you will find an item in the bill to the effect. Let me see. He picked up a flimsy carbon copy lying near him. Detecting and triangulating the vectors of interconnectedness of all things, £150, we've dealt with that. Tracing same to beach in Bahamas, fare and accommodation, a mere £1,500. The accommodation was, of course, distressingly modest. Ah, yes, here we are, struggling on in the face of draining scepticism from client. Drinks, £327.50. Would that I did not have to make such charges, my dear Mrs. Sorskind. Would that the occasion did not continually arise. Not believing in my methods only makes my job more difficult, Mrs. Sorskind, and hence, regrettably, more expensive. Upstairs, the sounds of argument were becoming more heated by the moment. The French voice seemed to be verging on hysteria. I do appreciate, Mrs. Sorskin, continued Dirk, that the cost of the investigation has strayed somewhat from the original estimate, but I'm sure you will in your turn appreciate that a job which takes 7 years to do must clearly be more difficult than one that can be pulled off in an afternoon, and must therefore be charged at a higher rate. I have continually to revise my estimate of how difficult the task is, in the light of how difficult it has so far proved to be. The babble from the phone became more frantic. My dear Mrs. Sorskind, or may I call you Joyce? Very well, then, my dear Mrs. Sorskind, let me say this. Do not worry yourself about the bill. Do not let it alarm or discomfort you. Do not, I beg you, let it become a source of anxiety to you. Just grit your teeth and pay it. He pulled his feet down off the table and leaned forward over the desk, inching the telephone receiver inexorably back towards its cradle. As always, the very greatest pleasure to speak with you, Mrs. Sorskind. For now, goodbye. He at last put down the receiver, picked it up again, and dropped it for the moment into the wastepaper basket. My dear Richard Macduff, he said, producing a large flat box from under his desk and pushing it across the table at him, your pizza. Richard stared back in astonishment. No thanks, he said. I had breakfast. Please, you have it. Dirk shrugged. I told them you'd pop in and settle up over the weekend, he said. Welcome, by the way, to my offices. He waved a vague hand around the tatty surroundings. The light works, he said, indicating the window. The gravity works, he said, dropping a pencil on the floor. Anything else we have to take our chances with. Richard cleared his throat. What, he said, is this? What is what? This, exclaimed Richard, all this, you appear to have a holistic detective agency, and I don't even know what one is. I provide a service that is unique in the world, said Dirk. The term holistic refers to my conviction that what we are concerned with here is the fundamental interconnectedness of... Yes, I got that bit earlier, said Richard. I have to say that it sounded a bit like an excuse for exploiting gullible old ladies. Exploiting? Asked Dirk. Well, I suppose it would be if anybody ever paid me, but I do assure you, my dear Richard, that there never seems to be the remotest danger of that. I live in what are known as hopes. I hope for fascinating and remunerative cases. My secretary hopes that I will pay her. Her landlord hopes that she will produce some rent. The electricity board hopes that he will settle their bill, and so on. I find it a wonderfully optimistic way of life. Meanwhile, I give a lot of charming and silly old ladies something to be happily cross about and virtually guarantee the freedom of their cats. Is there, you ask, and I put the question for you because I know you know I hate to be interrupted, is there a single case that exercises the tiniest part of my intellect, which, as you hardly need me to tell you, is prodigious? No. But do I despair? Am I downcast? Yes. Until, he added, today. Oh, well, I'm glad of that, said Richard. But what was all that rubbish about cats and quantum mechanics? With a sigh, Dirk flipped open the lid of the pizza with a single flick of practiced fingers. He surveyed the cold round thing with a kind of sadness, and then tore off a hunk of it. Pieces of pepperoni and anchovy scattered over his desk. I am sure, Richard, he said, that you are familiar with the notion of Schrödinger's cat, and he stuffed the larger part of the hunk into his mouth. Of course, said Richard, well, reasonably familiar. What is it? Said Dirk, through a mouthful. Richard shifted in his seat. It's an illustration, he said, of the principle that at a quantum level all events are governed by probabilities. At a quantum level, and therefore at all levels, interrupted Dirk, though at any level higher than the subatomic, the cumulative effect of those probabilities is, in the normal course of events, indistinguishable from the effect of hard and fast physical laws. Continue. He put some more cold pizza into his face. Richard reflected that Dirk's was a face into which too much had already been put. What with that and the amount he talked, the traffic through his mouth was almost incessant. His ears, on the other hand, remained almost totally unused in normal conversation. It occurred to Richard that if Lamarck had been right, and you were to take a line through this behaviour for several generations, the chances were that some radical replumbing of the interior of the skull would eventually take place. Richard continued, Not only are quantum level events governed by probabilities, but those probabilities aren't even resolved into actual events until they are measured, or to use a phrase I just heard you use in a rather bizarre context, the act of measurement collapses the probability waveform. Up until that point, all the possible courses of action open to, say, an electron coexist as probability waveforms. Nothing is decided until it's measured. Dirk nodded. More or less, he said, taking another mouthful. But what of the cat? Richard decided there was only one way to avoid having to watch Dirk eat his way through all the rest of the pizza, and that was to eat the rest himself. He rolled it up and took a token nibble of the end. It was rather good. He took another bite. Dirk watched this with startled dismay. So, said Richard, the idea behind Schrödinger's cat was to try and imagine a way in which the effects of probabilistic behaviour at a quantum level could be considered at a macroscopic level, or, let's say, at an everyday level. Yes, let's, said Dirk, regarding the rest of the pizza with a stricken look. Richard took another bite and continued cheerfully. So, you imagine that you take a cat and put it in a box that you can seal completely. Also in the box you put a small lump of radioactive material and a phial of poison gas. You arrange it so that within a given time period there is an exactly 50-50 chance that an atom in the radioactive lump will decay and emit an electron. If it does decay, then it triggers the release of the gas and kills the cat. If it doesn't, the cat lives. 50-50. Depending on the 50-50 chance that a single atom does or does not decay. The point, as I understand it, is this. Since the decay of a single atom is a quantum-level event that wouldn't be resolved either way until it was observed, and since you don't make the observation until you open the box and see whether the cat is alive or dead, then there's a rather extraordinary consequence. Until you do open the box, the cat exists in an indeterminate state. The possibility that it is alive and the possibility that it is dead are two different waveforms superimposed on each other inside the box. Schrödinger put forward this idea to illustrate what he thought was absurd about quantum theory. Dirk got up and padded over to the window, probably not so much for the meager view it afforded over an old warehouse on which an alternative comedian was lavishing his vast lager commercial fees, developing into luxury apartments, as for the lack of view it afforded of the last piece of pizza disappearing. Exactly, said Dirk. Bravo. But what's all this got to do with this detective agency? Said Richard. Oh, that. Well, some researchers were once conducting such an experiment, but when they opened up the box, the cat was neither alive nor dead, but was in fact completely missing, and they called me in to investigate. I was able to deduce that nothing very dramatic had happened. The cat had merely got fed up with being repeatedly locked up in a box and occasionally gassed, and had taken the first opportunity to hoof it through the window. It was, for me, the work of a moment to set a saucer of milk by the window and call Bernice. In an enticing voice, the cat's name was Bernice, you understand. Now, wait a minute, said Richard. And the cat was soon restored, a simple enough matter, but it seemed to create quite an impression in certain circles, and soon one thing led to another, as they do, and it all culminated in the thriving career you see before you. Wait a minute, insisted Richard, slapping the table. Yes? Inquired Dirk, innocently. Now, what are you talking about, Dirk? You have a problem with what I have told you? Well, I hardly know where to begin, protested Richard. All right, you said that some people were performing the experiment. That's nonsense. Schrödinger's cat isn't a real experiment. It's just an illustration for arguing about the idea. It's not something you'd actually do. Dirk was watching him with odd attention. Oh, really? He said at last. And why not? Well, there's nothing you can test. The whole point of the idea is to think about what happens before you make your observation. You can't know what's going on inside the box without looking, and the very instant you look, the wave packet collapses and the probabilities resolve. It's self-defeating. It's completely purposeless. You are, of course, perfectly correct as far as you go, replied Dirk, returning to his seat. He drew a cigarette out of the packet, tapped it several times on the desk, and leant across the desk and pointed the filter at Richard. But think about this, he continued. Supposing you were to introduce a psychic, someone with clairvoyant powers, into the experiment, someone who is able to divine what state of health the cat is in without opening the box, someone who has, perhaps, a certain eerie sympathy with cats. What then? Might that furnish us with an additional insight into the problem of quantum physics? Is that what they wanted to do? It's what they did. Dirk, this is complete nonsense. Dirk raised his eyebrows challengingly. All right, said Richard, holding up his palms. Let's just follow it through. Even if I accepted, which I don't for one second, that there was any basis at all for clairvoyance, it wouldn't alter the fundamental undoableness of the experiment. As I said, the whole thing turns on what happens inside the box before it's observed. It doesn't matter how you observe it, whether you look into the box with your eyes or, well, with your mind, if you insist. If clairvoyance works, then it's just another way of looking into the box. And if it doesn't, then of course it's irrelevant. It might depend, of course, on the view you take of clairvoyance. Oh, yes, and what view do you take of clairvoyance? I should be very interested to know, given your history. Dirk tapped the cigarette on the desk again and looked narrowly at Richard. There was a deep and prolonged silence, disturbed only by the sound of distant crying in French. I take the view I have always taken, said Dirk eventually, which is that I am not clairvoyant. Really, said Richard, then what about those exam papers? The eyes of Dirk gently darkened at the mention of the subject. Coincidence, he said in a low, savage voice. A strange and chilling coincidence, but nonetheless a coincidence. One, I might add, which caused me to spend a considerable time in prison. Coincidences can be frightening and dangerous things. Dirk gave Richard another of his long, appraising looks. I have been watching you carefully, he said. You seem to be extremely relaxed for a man in your position. This seemed to Richard to be an odd remark, and he tried to make sense of it for a moment. Then the light dawned, and it was an aggravating light. Good heavens, he said. He hasn't got to you as well, has he? This remark seemed to puzzle Dirk in return. Who hasn't got to me? He said. Gordon. Well, no, obviously not. Gordon Way. He has this habit of trying to get other people to bring pressure on me to get on with what he sees as important work. I thought for a moment. Never mind. What did you mean, then? Ah, Gordon Way has this habit, has he? Yes, I don't like it. Why? Dirk looked long and hard at Richard, tapping a pencil lightly on the desk. Then he leaned back in his chair and said as follows. The body of Gordon Way was discovered before dawn this morning. He had been shot, strangled, and then his house was set on fire. Police are working on the theory that he was not actually shot in the house, because no shotgun pellets were discovered there, other than those in his body. However, pellets were found near to Mr. Way's Mercedes 500 SEC, which was found abandoned about 3 miles from his house. This suggests that the body was moved after the murder. Furthermore, the doctor who examined the body is of the opinion that Mr. Way was in fact strangled after he was shot, which seems to suggest a certain confusion in the mind of the killer. By a startling coincidence, it appears that the police last night had occasion to interview a very confused-seeming gentleman who said that he was suffering from some kind of guilt complex about having just run over his employer. That man was a Mr. Richard Macduff, and his employer was the deceased, Mr. Gordon Way. It has further been suggested that Mr. Richard Macduff is one of the two people most likely to benefit from Mr. Way's death, since Wayforward Technologies would almost certainly pass at least partly into his hands. The other person is his only living relative, Miss Susan Way, into whose flat Mr. Richard Macduff was observed to break last night. The police don't know that bit, of course, nor, if we can help it, will they? However, any relationship between the two of them will naturally come under close scrutiny. The news reports on the radio say they are urgently seeking Mr. Macduff, who they believe will be able to help them with their inquiries, but the tone of voice says that he is clearly guilty as hell. My scale of charges is as follows, £200 a day plus expenses. Expenses are not negotiable and will sometimes strike those who do not understand these matters as somewhat tangential. They are necessary and, as I say, not negotiable. Am I hired? Sorry, said Richard, nodding slightly. Would you start that again? Chapter 17. The Electric Monk hardly knew what to believe anymore. He had been through a bewildering number of belief systems in the previous few hours, most of which had failed to provide him with the long-term spiritual solace that it was his bounden programming eternally to seek. He was fed up, frankly, and tired and dispirited. And furthermore, which caught him by surprise, he rather missed his horse. A dull and menial creature, to be sure, and, as such, hardly worthy of the preoccupation of one whose mind was destined forever to concern itself with higher things beyond the understanding of a simple horse. But, nevertheless, he missed it. He wanted to sit on it. He wanted to pat it. He wanted to feel that it didn't understand. He wondered where it was. He dangled his feet disconsolately from the branch of the tree in which he had spent the night. He had climbed it in pursuit of some wild, fantastic dream, and then had got stuck and had to stay there till morning. Even now, by daylight, he wasn't certain how he was going to get down. He came for a moment perilously close to believing that he could fly, but a quick-thinking, error-checking protocol cut in and told him not to be so silly. It was a problem, though. Whatever burning fire of faith had borne him, inspired on wings of hope upwards through the branches of the tree in the magic hours of the night, had not also provided him with instructions on how to get back down again when, like altogether too many of those burning, fiery nighttime faiths, it had deserted him in the morning. And speaking, or rather thinking, of burning, fiery things, there had been a major burning, fiery thing a little distance from here in the early pre-dawn hours. It lay, he thought, in the direction from which he himself had come when he had been drawn by a deep spiritual compulsion towards this inconveniently high but otherwise embarrassingly ordinary tree. He had longed to go and worship at the fire, to pledge himself eternally to its holy glare, but while he had been struggling hopelessly to find a way downwards through the branches, fire engines had arrived and put the divine radiance out, and that had been another creed out of the window. The sun had been up for some hours now, and though he had occupied the time as best he could, believing in clouds, believing in twigs, believing in a peculiar form of flying beetle, he believed now that he was fed up, and was utterly convinced, furthermore, that he was getting hungry. He wished that he had taken the precaution of providing himself with some food from the dwelling place he had visited in the night, to which he had carried his sacred burden for entombment in the holy broom cupboard. But he had left in the grip of a white passion, believing that such mundane matters as food were of no consequence, that the tree would provide. Well, it had provided. It had provided twigs. Monks did not eat twigs. In fact, now he came to think of it, he felt a little uncomfortable about some of the things he had believed last night, and had found some of the results a little confusing. He had been quite clearly instructed to shoot off, and had felt strangely compelled to obey, but perhaps he had made a mistake in acting so precipitately on an instruction given in a language he had learnt only 2 minutes before. Certainly, the reaction of the person he had shot off at had seemed a little extreme. In his own world, when people were shot at like that, they came back next week for another episode. But he didn't think this person would be doing that. A gust of wind blew through the tree, making it sway giddily. He climbed down a little way. The first part was reasonably easy, since the branches were all fairly close together. It was the last bit that appeared to be an insuperable obstacle, a sheer drop which would cause him severe internal damage or rupture, and might in turn cause him to start believing things that were seriously strange. The sound of voices over in a distant corner of the field suddenly caught his attention. A lorry had pulled up by the side of the road. He watched carefully for a moment, but couldn't see anything particular to believe in, so he returned to his introspection. There was, he remembered, an odd function call he had had last night, which he hadn't encountered before, but he had a feeling that it might be something he'd heard of called remorse. He hadn't felt at all comfortable about the way the person he had shot at had just lain there, and after initially walking away, the monk had returned to have another look. There was definitely an expression on the person's face which seemed to suggest that something was up, that this didn't fit in with the scheme of things. The monk worried that he might have badly spoilt his evening. Still, he reflected, so long as you did what you believed to be right, that was the main thing. The next thing he had believed to be right was that having spoilt this person's evening, he should at least convey him to his home, and a quick search of his pockets had produced an address, some maps, and some keys. The trip had been an arduous one, but he had been sustained on the way by his faith. The word bathroom floated unexpectedly across the field. He looked up again at the lorry in the distant corner. There was a man in a dark blue uniform explaining something to a man in rough working clothes, who seemed a little disgruntled about whatever it was. The words, "until we trace the owner," and "completely batty, of course," were gusted over on the wind. The man in the working clothes clearly agreed to accept the situation, but with bad grace. A few moments later, a horse was led out of the back of the lorry and into the field. The monk blinked. His circuits thrilled and surged with astonishment. Now here at last was something he could believe in, a truly miraculous event, a reward at last for his unstinting, if rather promiscuous, devotion. The horse walked with a patient, uncomplaining gait. It had long grown used to being wherever it was put, but for once it felt it didn't mind this. Here, it thought, was a pleasant field. Here was grass. Here was a hedge it could look at. There was enough space that it could go for a trot later on if it felt the urge. The humans drove off and left it to its own devices, to which it was quite content to be left. It went for a little amble and then, just for the hell of it, stopped ambling. It could do what it liked. What pleasure! What very great and unaccustomed pleasure! It slowly surveyed the whole field and then decided to plan out a nice relaxed day for itself. A little trot later on, it thought, maybe round 3-ish. After that, a bit of a lie-down over on the east side of the field where the grass was thicker. It looked like a suitable spot to think about supper in. Lunch, it rather fancied, could be taken at the south end of the field, where a small stream ran. Lunch by a stream, for heaven's sake. This was bliss. It also quite liked the notion of spending half an hour walking alternately a little bit to the left and then a little bit to the right, for no apparent reason. It didn't know whether the time between 2 and 3 would be best spent swishing its tail or mulling things over. Of course, it could always do both if it so wished, and go for its trot a little later. It had just spotted what looked like a fine piece of hedge for watching things over, and that would easily while away a pleasant preprandial hour or two. Good. An excellent plan. And the best thing about it was that having made it, the horse could now completely and utterly ignore it. It went instead for a leisurely stand under the only tree in the field. From out of its branches, the electric monk dropped onto the horse's back with a cry which sounded suspiciously like Geronimo. Chapter 18. Dirk Gently briefly ran over the salient facts once more while Richard Macduff's world crashed slowly and silently into a dark, freezing sea which he hadn't even known was there, waiting inches beneath his feet. When Dirk had finished for the second time, the room fell quiet while Richard stared fixedly at his face.
"Where did you hear this?" said Richard at last.
"The radio," said Dirk with a slight shrug. "At least the main points. It's all over the news, of course. The details, well, discreet inquiries among contacts here and there. There are one or two people I got to know at Cambridge Police Station for reasons which may occur to you."
"I don't even know whether to believe you," said Richard quietly.
"May I use the phone?" Dirk courteously picked a telephone receiver out of the waste paper bin and handed it to him. Richard dialed Susan's number. The phone was answered almost immediately, and a frightened voice said, "Hello?
Susan, it's Richard, where are you? For God's sake, where are you? Are you all right?"
"Don't tell her where you are," said Dirk.
"Susan, what's happened?" "Well, don't you? Somebody told me that something's happened to Gordon, but something's happened. He's dead, Richard. He's been murdered."
"Hang up," said Dirk.
"Susan, listen, I..."
"Hang up," repeated Dirk, then leaned forward to the phone and cut him off. "The police will probably have a trace on the line," he explained. He took the receiver and chucked it back in the bin.
"But I have to go to the police," Richard exclaimed.
"Go to the police?
Well, what else can I do? I have to go to the police and tell them it wasn't me."
"Tell them that it wasn't you?" said Dirk incredulously.
"Well, I expect that'll probably make it all right then. Pity Dr. Crippen didn't think of that. Would have saved him a lot of bother."
"Yes, but he was guilty."
"Yes, so it would appear, and so it would appear at the moment are you."
"But I didn't do it, for God's sake."
"You are talking to someone who has spent time in prison for something he didn't do, remember.
I told you that coincidences are strange and dangerous things. Believe me, it is a great deal better to find cast-iron proof that you're innocent than to languish in a cell hoping that the police, who already think you're guilty, will find it for you."
"I can't think straight," said Richard with his hand to his forehead. "Just stop for a moment and let me think this out."
"If I may..."
"Let me think."
Dirk shrugged and turned his attention back to his cigarette, which seemed to be bothering him.
"It's no good," said Richard, shaking his head after a few moments. "I can't take it in. It's like trying to do trigonometry when someone's kicking your head. Okay, tell me what you think I should do."
"Hypnotism."
"What?"
"It is hardly surprising in the circumstances that you should be unable to gather your thoughts clearly. However, it is vital that somebody gathers them. It'll be much simpler for both of us if you will allow me to hypnotize you. I strongly suspect that there is a very great deal of information jumbled up in your head that will not emerge while you are shaking it up so, that might not emerge at all because you do not realize its significance. With your permission, we can shortcut all that."
"Well, that's decided then," said Richard, standing up. "I'm going to the police."
"Very well," said Dirk, leaning back and spreading his palms on the desk. "I wish you the very best of luck. Perhaps on your way out, you'd be kind enough to ask my secretary to get me some matches."
"You haven't got a secretary," said Richard, and left.
Dirk sat and brooded for a few seconds, made a valiant but vain attempt to fold the sadly empty pizza box into the waste paper bin, and then went to look in the cupboard for a metronome. Richard emerged blinking into the daylight. He stood on the top step, rocking slightly, then plunged off down the street with an odd kind of dancing walk, which reflected the whirling dance of his mind. On the one hand, he simply couldn't believe that the evidence wouldn't show perfectly clearly that he couldn't have committed the murder. On the other hand, he had to admit that it all looked remarkably odd. He found it impossible to think clearly or rationally about it. The idea that Gordon had been murdered kept blowing up in his mind and throwing all other thoughts into total confusion and disruption. It occurred to him for a moment that whoever did it must have been a damn fast shot to get the trigger pulled before being totally overwhelmed by waves of guilt, but instantly he regretted the thought. In fact, he was a little appalled by the general quality of the thoughts that sprang into his mind. They seemed inappropriate and unworthy, and mostly had to do with how it would affect his projects in the company. He looked about inside himself for any feeling of great sorrow or regret, and assumed that it must be there somewhere, probably hiding behind the huge wall of shock. He arrived back within sight of Islington Green, hardly noticing the distance he had walked. The sudden sight of the police squad car parked outside his house hit him like a hammer, and he swung on his heel and stared with furious concentration at the menu displayed in the window of a Greek restaurant. "Dolmades," he thought frantically. "Souvlaki," he thought. A small, spicy Greek sausage passed hectically through his mind.
He tried to reconstruct the scene in his mind's eye without turning round. There had been a policeman standing watching the street, and as far as he could recall from the brief glance he had, it looked as if the side door of the building which led up to his flat was standing open. The police were in his flat, Fasolia Plaki, a filling bowl of haricot beans cooked in a tomato and vegetable sauce. He tried to shift his eyes sideways and back over his shoulder. The policeman was looking at him. He yanked his eyes back to the menu and tried to fill his mind with finely ground meat mixed with potato, breadcrumbs, onions and herbs rolled into small balls and fried. The policeman must have recognised him and was at that very moment dashing across the road to grab him and lug him off in a black Mariah just as they had done to Dirk all those years ago in Cambridge. He braced his shoulders against the shock, but no hand came to grab him. He glanced back again, but the policeman was looking unconcernedly in another direction. Stiffado. It was very apparent to him that his behaviour was not that of one who was about to go and hand himself in to the police. So what else was he to do? Trying in a stiff, awkward way to walk naturally, he yanked himself away from the window, strolled tensely down the road a few yards, and then ducked back down Camden Passage again, walking fast and breathing hard. Where could he go? To Susan? No, the police would be there watching. To the Way Forward offices in Primrose Hill? No, same reason. What on earth, he screamed silently at himself, was he doing suddenly as a fugitive? He insisted to himself, as he had insisted to Dirk, that he should not be running away from the police. The police, he told himself, as he'd been taught when he was a boy, were there to help and protect the innocent. This thought caused him instantly to break into a run, and he nearly collided with the proud new owner of an ugly Edwardian floor lamp. Sorry, he said, sorry. He was startled that anyone should want such a thing, and slowed his pace to a walk, glancing with sharp, hunted looks around him. The very familiar shop fronts full of old polished brass, old polished wood and pictures of Japanese fish suddenly seemed very threatening and aggressive. Who could possibly have wanted to kill Gordon? This was the thought that suddenly hammered at him as he turned down Charlton Place. All that had occurred to him so far was that he hadn't. But who had? This was a new thought. Plenty of people didn't care for him much, but there is a huge difference between disliking somebody, maybe even disliking them a lot, and actually shooting them, strangling them, dragging them through the fields and setting their house on fire. It was a difference which kept the vast majority of the population alive from day to day. Was it just theft? Dirk hadn't mentioned anything being missing, but then he hasn't asked him. Dirk, the image of his absurd but oddly commanding figure, sitting like a large toad, brooding in his shabby office, kept insisting itself upon Richard's mind. He realised that he was retracing the way he had come, and deliberately made himself turn right instead of left. That way madness lay. He just needed a space, a bit of time to think and collect his thoughts together. All right, so where was he going? He stopped for a moment, turned around, and then stopped again. The idea of Dolmades suddenly seemed very attractive, and it occurred to him that the cool, calm, and collected course of action would have been simply to walk in and have some. That would have shown Fate who was boss. Instead, Fate was engaged on exactly the same course of action. It wasn't actually sitting in a Greek restaurant eating Dolmades, but it might as well have been because it was clearly in charge. Richard's footsteps drew him inexorably back through the winding streets, over the canal. He stopped briefly at a corner shop and then hurried on past the council estates and into developer territory again until he was standing once more outside 33 Peckender Street. At about the same time as Fate would have been pouring itself the last of the Retsina, wiping its mouth and wondering if it had any room left for baklavas, Richard gazed up at the tall, ruddy Victorian building with its soot-darkened brickwork and its heavy, forbidding windows. A gust of wind whipped along the street and a small boy bounded up to him. "Fuck off!" chirped the little boy, then paused and looked at him again. "Here, mister," he added, "can I have your jacket?" "No," said Richard. "Why not?" said the boy. "Because I like it," said Richard. "Can't see why," muttered the boy. "Fuck off!" He slouched off moodily down the street, kicking a stone at a cat. Richard entered the building once more, mounted the stairs uneasily, and looked again into the office. Dirk's secretary was sitting at her desk, head down, arms folded. "I'm not here," she said. "I see," said Richard. "I only came back," she said, without looking up from the spot on her desk at which she was staring angrily, "to make sure he notices that I've gone, otherwise he might just forget." "Is he in?" asked Richard. "Who knows? Who cares? Better ask someone who works for him, because I don't." "Show him in," boomed Dirk's voice. She glowered for a moment, stood up, went to the inner door, wrenched it open, and said, "Show him in yourself!" Slammed the door once more and returned to her seat. "Why don't I just show myself in?" said Richard. "I can't even hear you," said Dirk's ex-secretary, staring resolutely at her desk. "How do you expect me to hear you if I'm not even here?" Richard made a placatory gesture, which was ignored, and walked through and opened the door to Dirk's office himself. He was startled to find the room in semi-darkness. A blind was drawn down over the window, and Dirk was lounging back in his seat, his face bizarrely lit by the strange arrangement of objects sitting on the desk. At the forward edge of the desk sat an old grey bicycle lamp, facing backwards and shining a feeble light on a metronome which was ticking softly back and forth, with a highly polished silver teaspoon strapped to its metal rod. Richard tossed a couple of boxes of matches onto the desk. "Sit down, relax, and keep looking at the spoon," said Dirk. "You are already feeling sleepy." Another police car pulled itself up to a screeching halt outside Richard's flat, and a grim-faced man climbed out and strode over to one of the constables on duty outside, flashing an identity card. "Detective Inspector Mason, Cambridgeshire CID," he said. "This the Macduff place?" The constable nodded and showed him to the side door entrance, which opened onto the long, narrow staircase leading up to the top flat. Mason bustled in and then bustled straight out again. "There's a sofa halfway up the stairs," he told the constable. "Get it moved." "Some of the lads have already tried, sir," the constable replied anxiously. "It seems to be stuck. Everyone's having to climb over it for the moment, sir. Sorry, sir." Mason gave him another grim look from a vast repertoire he had developed, which ranged from very, very blackly grim indeed, at the bottom of the scale, all the way up to tiredly resigned and only faintly grim, which he reserved for his children's birthdays. "Get it moved," he repeated grimly, and bustled grimly back through the door, grimly hauling up his trousers and coat in preparation for the grim ascent ahead. "No sign of him yet?" asked the driver of the car, coming over himself. "Sergeant Gilkes," he introduced himself. He looked tired. "Not as far as I know," said the constable, "but no one tells me anything." "No, how you feel," agreed Gilkes. "Once the CID gets involved, you just get relegated to driving them about. I'm the only one who knows what he looked like. Stopped him in the road last night. We just came from Way's house. Right mess. Bad night, eh?" "Varied. Everything from murder to hauling horses out of bathrooms. No, don't even ask. Do you have the same cars as these?" he added, pointing at his own. "This one's been driving me crazy all the way up, cold even with the heater on full blast, and the radio keeps turning itself on and off." Chapter 19. The same morning found Michael Wenton Weeks in something of an odd mood. You would need to know him fairly well to know that it was an especially odd mood, because most people regarded him as being a little odd to start with. Few people knew him that well. His mother, perhaps, but there existed between them a state of cold war, and neither had spoken to the other now in weeks. He also had an elder brother, Peter, who was now tremendously senior in the Marines. Apart from at their father's funeral, Michael had not seen Peter since he came back from the Falklands, covered in glory, promotion, and contempt for his younger brother. Peter had been delighted that their mother had taken over Magna, and had sent Michael a regimental Christmas card to that effect. His own greatest satisfaction still remained that of throwing himself into a muddy ditch and firing a machine gun for at least a minute. And he didn't think the British newspaper and publishing industry, even in its current state of unrest, was likely to afford him that pleasure, at least until some more Australians moved into it. Michael had risen very late, after a night of cold savagery and then of troubled dreams, which still disturbed him now in the late morning daylight. His dreams had been filled with the familiar sensations of loss, isolation, guilt, and so forth, but had also been inexplicably involved with large quantities of mud. By the telescopic power of the nightmare of mud and loneliness had seemed to stretch on for terrifying, unimaginable lengths of time, and had only been concluded by the appearance of slimy things with legs that had crawled in the slimy sea. This had been altogether too much, and he had woken with a start in a cold sweat. Though all the business with the mud had seemed strange to him, the sense of loss, of isolation, and above all the aggrievement, the need to undo what had been done, these had all found an easy home in his spirit. Even the slimy things with legs seemed oddly familiar and ticked away irritably at the back of his mind while he made himself a light breakfast, a piece of grapefruit and some China tea, allowed his eyes to rest lightly on the arts pages of the Daily Telegraph for a while, and then rather clumsily changed the dressing on the cuts on his hand. These small tasks accomplished, he was then in two minds as to what to do next. He was able to view the events of the previous night with a cool detachment that he would not have expected. It had been right, it had been proper, it had been correctly done. But it resolved nothing. All that mattered was yet to be done. Or what? He frowned at the odd way his thoughts ebbed and flowed. Normally he would pop along to his club at about this time. It used to be that he would do this with a luxurious sense of the fact that there were many other things that he should be doing. Now there was nothing else to do, which made time spent there, as anywhere else, hang somewhat heavy on his hands. When he went, he would do as he always did, indulge in a gin and tonic and a little light conversation, and then allow his eyes to rest gently on the pages of the Times Literary Supplement, Opera, The New Yorker, or whatever else fell easily to hand. But there was no doubt that he did it these days with less verve and relish than previously. Then there would be lunch. Today he had no lunch date planned, again, and would therefore probably have stayed at his club and eaten a lightly grilled Dover sole with potatoes garnished with parsley and boiled to bits, followed by a large heap of trifle, a glass or two of Sancerre, and coffee, and then the afternoon with whatever that might bring. But today he felt oddly impelled not to do that. He flexed the muscles in his cut hand, poured himself another cup of tea, looked with curious dispassion at the large kitchen knife that still lay by the fine bone china teapot, and waited for a moment to see what he would do next. What he did next, in fact, was to walk upstairs. His house was rather chill in its formal perfection, and looked much as people who buy reproduction furniture would like their houses to look, except, of course, that everything here was genuine. Crystal, mahogany, and Wilton, and only looked as if it might be fake because there was no life to any of it. He walked up to his workroom, which was the only room in the house that was not sterile with order, but here the disorder of books and papers was instead sterile with neglect. A thin film of dust had settled over everything. Michael had not been into it in weeks, and the cleaner was under strict instructions to leave it well alone. He had not worked here since he edited the last edition of Fathom. Not, of course, the actual last edition, but the last proper edition. The last edition as far as he was concerned. He set his china cup down in the fine dust and went to inspect his elderly record player. On it he found an elderly recording of some Vivaldi wind concertos, set it to play, and sat down. He waited again to see what he would do next, and suddenly found to his surprise that he was already doing it, and it was this. He was listening to the music. A bewildered look crept slowly across his face as he realized that he had never done this before. He had heard it many, many times, and thought that it made a very pleasant noise. Indeed, he found that it made a pleasant background against which to discuss the concert season, but it had never occurred to him that there was anything actually to listen to. He sat thunderstruck by the interplay of melody and counterpoint, which suddenly stood revealed to him with a clarity that owed nothing to the dust-ridden surface of the record or the 14-year-old stylus. But with this revelation came an almost immediate sense of disappointment, which confused him all the more. The music suddenly revealed to him was oddly unfulfilling. It was as if his capacity to understand the music had suddenly increased up to and far beyond the music's ability to satisfy it, all in one dramatic moment. He strained to listen for what was missing, and felt that the music was like a flightless bird that didn't even know what capacity it had lost. It walked very well, but it walked where it should soar, walked where it should swoop. It walked where it should climb and bank and dive. It walked where it should thrill with the giddiness of flight. It never even looked up. He looked up. After a while, he became aware that all he was doing was simply staring stupidly at the ceiling. He shook his head and discovered that the perception had faded, leaving him feeling slightly sick and dizzy. It had not vanished entirely, but had dropped deep inside him, deeper than he could reach. The music continued. It was an agreeable enough assortment of pleasant sounds in the background, but it no longer stirred him. He needed some clues as to what it was he had just experienced, and a thought flicked momentarily at the back of his mind as to where he might find them. He let go of the thought in anger, but it flicked at him again and kept on flicking at him until at last he acted upon it. From under his desk he pulled out the large tin waste paper bin. Since he had barred his cleaning lady from even coming in here for the moment, the bin had remained unemptied, and he found in it the tattered shreds of what he was looking for, with the contents of an ashtray emptied over them. He overcame his distaste with grim determination, and slowly jiggled around the bits of the hated object on his desk, clumsily sticking them together with bits of sticky tape, that curled around and stuck the wrong bit to the wrong bit and stuck the right bit to his pudgy fingers and then to the desk, until at last there lay before him, crudely reassembled, a copy of Fathom, as edited by the execrable creature A.K. Ross. Appalling. He turned the sticky, lumpish pages as if he were picking over chicken giblets. Not a single line drawing of Joan Sutherland or Marilyn Horne anywhere. No profiles of any of the major Cork Street art dealers, not a one. His series on the Rossettis, discontinued. Greenroom gossip, discontinued. He shook his head in incredulity. and then he found the article he was after. Music and Fractal Landscapes by Richard Macduff. He skipped over the first couple of paragraphs of introduction and picked it up further on. Mathematical analysis and computer modelling are revealing to us that the shapes and processes we encounter in nature, the way that plants grow, the way that mountains erode or rivers flow, the way that snowflakes or islands achieve their shapes, the way that light plays on a surface, the way the milk folds and spins into your coffee as you stir it, the way that laughter sweeps through a crowd of people, all these things in their seemingly magical complexity can be described by the interaction of mathematical processes that are, if anything, even more magical in their simplicity. Shapes that we think of as random are in fact the products of complex shifting webs of numbers obeying simple rules. The very word natural that we have often taken to mean unstructured in fact describes shapes and processes that appear so unfathomably complex that we cannot consciously perceive the simple natural laws at work. They can all be described by numbers. Oddly, this idea seemed less revolting now to Michael than it had done on his first scant reading. He read on with increasing concentration. We know, however, that the mind is capable of understanding these matters in all their complexity and in all their simplicity. A ball flying through the air is responding to the force and direction with which it was thrown, the action of gravity, the friction of the air which it must expend its energy on overcoming, the turbulence of the air around its surface, and the rate and direction of the ball's spin. And yet, someone who might have difficulty consciously trying to work out what 3 times 4 times 5 comes to would have no trouble in doing differential calculus and a whole host of related calculations so astoundingly fast that they can actually catch a flying ball. People who call this instinct are merely giving the phenomenon a name, not explaining anything. I think that the closest that human beings come to expressing our understanding of these natural complexities is in music. It is the most abstract of the arts. It has no meaning or purpose other than to be itself. Every single aspect of a piece of music can be represented by numbers. From the organization of movements in a whole symphony, down to the patterns and pitch of rhythm that make up the melodies and harmonies, the dynamics that shape the performance, all the way down to the timbres of the notes themselves, their harmonics, the way they change over time, in short, all the elements of a noise that distinguish between the sound of one person piping on a piccolo and another one thumping a drum. All of these things can be expressed by patterns and hierarchies of numbers. And in my experience, the more internal relationships there are between the patterns of numbers at different levels of the hierarchy, however complex and subtle those relationships may be, the more satisfying and, well, whole the music will seem to be. In fact, the more subtle and complex those relationships, and the more they are beyond the grasp of the conscious mind, the more the instinctive part of your mind, by which I mean that part of your mind that can do differential calculus so astoundingly fast that it will put your hand in the right place to catch a flying ball, the more that part of your brain revels in it. Music of any complexity, and even Three Blind Mice is complex in its way by the time someone has actually performed it on an instrument with its own individual timbre and articulation, passes beyond your conscious mind into the arms of your own private mathematical genius, who dwells in your unconscious, responding to all the inner complexities and relationships and proportions that we think we know nothing about. Some people object to such a view of music, saying that if you reduce music to mathematics, where does the emotion come into it? I would say that it's never been out of it. The things by which our emotions can be moved, the shape of a flower or a Grecian urn, the way a baby grows, the way the wind brushes across your face, the way clouds move, their shapes, the way light dances on the water or daffodils flutter in the breeze, the way in which the person you love moves their head, the way their hair follows that movement, the curve described by the dying fall of the last chord of a piece of music, all these can be described by the complex flow of numbers. That's not a reduction of it, that's the beauty of it. Ask Newton, ask Einstein. Ask the poet, Keats, who said that what the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth. He might also have said that what the hand seizes as a ball must be truth, but he didn't, because he was a poet and preferred loafing about under trees with a bottle of laudanum and a notebook to playing cricket, but it would have been equally true. This jogged a thought at the back of Michael's memory, but he couldn't immediately place it. Because that is at the heart of the relationship between, on the one hand, our instinctive understanding of shape, form, movement, light, and on the other hand, our emotional responses to them. And that is why I believe that there must be a form of music inherent in nature, in natural objects, in the patterns of natural processes. A music that would be as deeply satisfying as any naturally occurring beauty. And our own deepest emotions are, after all, a form of naturally occurring beauty. Michael stopped reading and let his gaze gradually drift from the page. He wondered if he knew what such a music would be and tried to grope in the dark recesses of his mind for it. Each part of his mind that he visited seemed as if that music had been playing there only seconds before, and all that was left was the last dying echo of something he was unable to catch at and hear. He laid the magazine limply aside. Then he remembered what it was that the mention of Keats had jogged in his memory. The slimy things with legs from his dream.